Welcome to Nostalgia Ultras, the football podcast living off past glories. I'm Steve McGovern, and today I'm joined by none other than former Wales and Everton goalkeeper Neville Southall. Neville, it's great to have you on. How is it going?
It's going well, thank you. Just got home from work, so yeah, I might sound tired, but I'm okay.
You've obviously released your book, Mind Games, and it's all to do with, you know, taking your experiences of football and applying them to life and different aspects of kind of just everyday life, really. And you wrote the book with Daniel Storey, and I spoke to Daniel actually a few weeks ago about it. And how was the process kind of working with him?
It was good, to be fair. I mean, when HarperCollins come to me and said, look, we want you to write a book about basically sort of football, but around the stuff you do on Twitter and your thoughts around the things that you promote and, you know, obviously what we cover on Twitter. With Daniel come down and come to my house a few times, and he was great to work with, to be fair. He's obviously a top journalist, so I just let him crack on with it, really, and I just talked. So it was quite easy, really. I mean, it was a nice thing to be able to do. You can tell in the book, I think, which are my words and which are Dan's words, because all mine are sort of short four-letter words, and he's gone for the Shakespeare look, I think.
Definitely, yeah. Well, he's a fabulous writer, and I think you guys definitely have kind of meshed well together in this book. Just to get onto your kind of playing career, though, because you won a lot, and you're the most decorated Everton player of all time. But you say in the book that you didn't enjoy the adulation that would kind of be showered over the team, and, you know, showing off the trophy in the aftermath of success wasn't like your thing. A lot of people would say that's almost like the point of winning, kind of especially at that high level. So why didn't you enjoy that aspect of it?
I think I found it embarrassing, to be fair. It's great to win. I'm not saying it's not great to win. It's fantastic to win. But there's two ways to look at it, I think. There's one, we're all relieved that we've won. But the other one is, but we expect to win. So why are we suddenly shocked when we do? And I think I got caught between the two. I was walking on the pitch with the FA Cup or the league and thinking, well, this is what we expect to do. This is why we train. This is what we do. And then we're here getting so happy about something that we've expected to do. I suppose it's part relief from everybody's point of view that you've won it. But I was walking around going, yeah, but now we've won it. That's it, isn't it? You enjoy it and then you just put it aside and you try and win the next one. The only thing with winning is that you know what you've got to lose the next time.
Yeah.
And that's why all the great teams who keep winning have got great players with great mental attitudes, because it's only until you win something you realise what you've got to lose. And that can be a big barrier to success. And that's a hard thing. People don't realise that, you know. And I know you're over in Ireland, aren't you, where there's loads of Man United fans and Liverpool fans and stuff like that. And they go, oh, yeah, but we should win this. Yeah, you know, you should win it, but sometimes the players don't get the respect of continuously doing it. And then the hard bit is continuous, because it is a real battle, because it gets harder. I don't think it gets easier. Yes, you have a bigger bank of experience to draw on, but also along with that comes the fear of failure, the expectation, you know, and I think what it means to the club. You realise all of them things once you want something. If you're a one-off and say you get to an FA Cup final and you're never expected to win it against the odds, and I suppose you never got another chance again, then yeah, I could see you going mad, because that's just a one-off chance. But in the main, you know, you look at tennis and golf, the same people tend to be at the top all the time. And it's the mental battle with knowing what's at stake and putting that to the side and concentrating on what you do well. You know, there's a tendency sometimes once you've won some, not to go as hard and as fast the next time out. And that's the challenge. And the challenge is the motivation probably to keep on winning. But for me, that was always going into training and thinking that I can't see the point of training or playing if we're not going to try and win the league and win cups. You know, and I think it's been devalued a little bit now, because, you know, a cup's a cup and winning's winning, and it's a good habit to have, and it teaches you lots of things. And I think, you know, with the Carabao Cup and the other cups, people putting what they say is their reserve side out is, one, a disservice to the competition, but also waters down their aspirations, I think, and the aspirations of the fans. And I don't think that's right. And it's a massive con, because if you have 25 men in a squad, like they all have to now, then if them 25 aren't capable of playing in the first team, what are they doing there?
Yeah.
So we can always say it's a reserve team, a weakened team, but really we should be saying It's the people who can't, people who aren't playing as well as the ones in the first team. They're not reserves and they're not failures. They're just one reason or they're not getting in the team. And, you know, if they're youngsters, then, yeah, it's fine. But I still think if it's a chance of a trophy for your club, then you're mad not to snatch it.
Absolutely.
Was that a short enough answer?
No, that was perfect. You're a teetotaler. So I'm curious to know, like, what was it like being a non-drinker in a football culture back in the day that, you know, as we've heard, was so big on drink? And was the culture actually as boozy as it's been made out to be?
I think, I'm not sure really. I mean, I can only judge it off what I've seen with Evan and Wales. Daft as it seems, at that time, it was important for the players to be able to do what they needed to do. It never bothered me. I was quite happy not drinking. Howard did try a couple of times, and then, you know, once I told him to go away politely a couple of times, he just left me alone, really. But I think you've got to remember in them days that the thing was, show no fear, show no hurt, and it must come out in some other way. Your emotions must come out somewhere else. So I suppose, in a bizarre way, beer probably took the place of psychologists. They've got psychologists now. They've got everything they need now. You know, people were feeling their way in the game and just doing really what they've seen their predecessors do. So in a way, it was learned behaviour. So I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't a massive problem, because it's only a massive problem when you've got bad professionals, because there's a time to drink and there's a time not to drink. And most of the good professionals would only drink when they needed to drink, or, you know, when they were allowed to drink. And you could always tell on a Monday morning, Evan, who'd had a couple of drinks, because they'd stay behind on a Monday and do extra work. So if you've got good pros like that, then you trust people, you know, and that's what Howard did. He trusted people, and I think that was a good thing. You know, after all, you're grown men making your own choices. If you want to throw it away down a bottle, then I suppose he thought, well, you're not good enough for us at the moment. And trouble is, addiction can be a bad thing at times, and, well, most of the time, to be fair, but, you know, addiction's a real problem. So I suppose in one way it was a comfort blanket for a lot, which led them to other problems. But in the main, how else are you supposed to get out of your system? How else are you supposed to, you know, for them to relax? It was their way of doing it. They found a way that was comfortable for them. I don't think everybody went and got, you know, pissed after every game and went berserk, but there's times when they did, because everybody needs a blowout sometime, don't they? And, you know, everybody needs a release on their valve, and sometimes you get it from that, and sometimes you just get it from going and have a game of golf, and sometimes you get it by winning. And sometimes, bizarrely, you get it through losing, because you're so angry that it makes you so wiped up for the next game.
You pose some interesting questions on page 49 of the book, and it's mainly to do with kind of modern day footballers. And you bring up this whole thing about how players today are all super fit, but some of them are deemed unable to go the full 90. And you ask, is that because the game is more intense and more demanding? Perhaps. But is it also because we've created an environment in which players are psychologically programmed to break down because they've been left unprepared for obstacles in the road by the lack of expression allowed in their personal lives? I'd love for you to expand on that, because just that notion, you said that they're psychologically programmed to break down. What exactly did you mean by that? Because I haven't really seen that idea put forth by anyone else before.
Well, have you ever heard a manager tell you what a player can do? More or less, if you're at a football club, there's people telling you can't play this many games. You can't play on this type of pitch. You've got to have this. We've got to coach you in that. You must do this at this time. It's like taking all away all the individuality, but they're telling them that they can't do things. To me, it's a really negative message. Football and life is about dreaming and thinking that you can do something. You know, there's people who are going to be reading the book and who's going to get up every day in the world going, I wish I could do this. I want to do that. I wish I could. And really, we should be saying, well, why can't you then? What's stopping you? We just do it the other way. Well, you know, he can't play 90 minutes. Why can't he play 90 minutes? Why isn't he fit enough to play 100 minutes? What is it? Is it physical? Because I can't see it physical, because they're all supposed to be as fit as anything. Is it mental? They're supposed to have the best psychologists. So I would like someone to tell me and sit down and go, this is the reason why. And you can't tell me it's because they're tired, because they don't work in a factory from 5 to 6 every day. So, I mean, they don't do that. So what is it that stops them? And what is it that stops them over a season not completing the number of games. I'm sure we play between about 70 and 90 games a season at some stage. Now, if you're losing every week, yeah, you do get more tired. If you're winning, you don't really feel it. But when you're tired, everything's negative. And I'm thinking, well, if you're telling me that, you know, we have to be careful with you, we have to do blood tests because you might be carrying a cold, you might be doing this, you know, come in, you're doing too much on the training ground. Everything's geared to saying, but you're doing this, and you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. And really, the human brain and the body can do whatever it wants to do within reason. There is no limits, but we're limiting everybody. And it's the same in any walk of life. You know, if people had that attitude when they came back from Afghanistan with no legs, they would never walk again. But they don't have that attitude. The attitude when we bring back injured troops is that, yes, you can do it. Yes, you can. What is the difference? Because these are all gym-fit people who are supposed to be super fit and the best prepared we've ever had them. Now, if they're the best prepared we've ever had them and they can't last 90 minutes, we're doing something wrong, aren't we? Because I think there's a whole culture that we've got that tells everybody what they can't do. And is that the way we want our kids to grow up? Is that the way we want our team to play? You know, imagine with, you know, 20 minutes to go, you go, well, we're not going to win. Because, you know, that's the way it is. We've been told that, you know, we're going to get tired. So we get tired. You know, you tell somebody can't play four games a month, he starts believing it. And we've seen, daft as it seems, we've seen in America and we've seen in Britain how much shit people actually believe. Because we've got two of the biggest liars in the world at the moment in charge of two big countries. And they just basically lie and then say they haven't said it. And yet people lap it up. So people are susceptible to things if you keep saying it all the time. And I think I'd rather reach for the stars and try and get there rather than go, well, it's no point in trying, is it? And I think it's one of them things, you know, if you were a Leicester player when Leicester won the league, they believed it.
Yeah.
They believed it going in. They believed it was possible. Now, does that come from the manager? Does that come from the players? But if you're a player, surely you want to be the best in the world. Surely you want to be the best in your position. Surely you want to do as well as you can for yourself, your family, the club, the fans, whatever it is. Why go into a sport and want to be mediocre at it? I can't get that. I don't think anybody does, but it seems to be that way, you know, we're fed that. You know, you imagine going in at Norwich when they weren't going to add much to their squad to go to the Premier League. There must have been a feeling around that, like, well, you know, we're going to come straight down. And I think some of that is belief. And that comes from the whole philosophy of the clubs and the whole philosophy of the place. You know, we can only do this because we're only this size club. I keep hearing that as well. We can't compete because we haven't got the money. We haven't got this. Well, they're barriers. They're barriers to winning stuff. They're barriers you're putting players in front of and telling them they can't get past it. You're telling the fans that even though you pay your whatever it is for your season ticket, yeah, we ain't going to win the league, but you should be really happy with 17th place because we're playing the Premier League. And I think that's a horrendous attitude to have because it's cheating the people, it's cheating the players, and it's cheating yourself. Why not go and say, look, we might be a small club, we might only have limited funds, but you've seen what Sheffield United done, you've seen what Leicester done. There's always going to be teams that can do well. And it's about, you know, and to be fair, Burnley the same. Got a style of play not everybody likes. And they graft and they graft and they graft. And they get through every season. And they maximise what they got. And I think if you're a club and you maximise everything you've got, then that's great. I think if you don't maximise what you got, then you're an idiot. And I think, you know, the Premier League is an easy league in some ways because if you haven't got a striker who could score you so many goals a season, you're going to go down because nobody survives on their defence alone, really. It's goals scored because you have to win games. And everybody that comes up goes, well, tell you what, we need to strengthen the back. Well, you do, but the one thing you do need is goals because you're going to let goals in. And all the bottom teams get a lot more goals in than everybody else. So if you've got a striker, you've got to say, well, okay, we need two strikers and we need to score more goals than the rest because it's as simple as that. Even if we win 4-3 every week, it's still 3 points. So, but it comes back to, we come into the Premier League from the Championship and everyone thinks you've got to change your way. And I'm really glad what Sheffield United have done, because and Burnley, because they've just stuck to what they do. But in the main, you know, somebody coming up to the Premier League and trying to out-football Man United or Everton or you know, Man City or Arsenal or Liverpool, you know, not really going to happen. So you have to play to what you've actually got. And we seem scared to be different. And I don't know whether it's because people have, managers have a really short space of time to work with clubs. And chairmen are really, really, will have no patience whatsoever because fans put pressure on them. So I think we are living in a Britain's Got Talent Premier League at the moment, where you can get a buzz and you're out the door, and it doesn't matter whether you have six games or you have 60 games, you can still be out the door, drop of a hat. And I think the fear from the managers is, you know, obviously getting the sack and having the time, so they're under pressure, which makes them in turn try and coach the players to death to make sure they get their message. Well, in all fairness, would bore the arse off you. So it's about trust, I think. If you've got good players, you just say, look, go out and play. Even if you haven't got good players, you give them a good framework and you rely on their character and their judgment, or else you don't sign them. So for me, you've got to look at your recruitment, because the recruitment will actually drive your club up, down, and that's it.
I wonder, actually, because on the injury bit you said there, and players not playing 90 minutes, I know, like, Jurgen Klopp and Mauricio Pochettino in the past have basically said, oh, it's all in your mind. Injuries aren't real. They literally play this kind of mind trick. So I wonder if that's part of their success.
The easiest way, to be fair, to sum it up right, is that when the SAS go in the morning and they say, I'll tell you what we'll do today, lads, we'll work from 9 till 10 because we'll never have to go beyond our capabilities. All the top people go beyond their capabilities. That's what great footballers do. They go beyond what they're supposed to go beyond. That's what great champions do. That's what great boxers, that's great journalists, great everything go beyond. So we've got to make sure that people understand that they can go further. They can do something else. If you keep trying to keep them at a level, it doesn't work. At some stage, you have to go beyond what you've got. Whether you play 100 minutes or 150 minutes, you have to go beyond. So your brain's got to be focused on going that extra mile. And yet we seem to have got the players and the coaches in a vice and saying, right, that's all you can do. And I think that's wrong. And I think if I was going into school tomorrow and I was telling the kids going, well, you know, you can't do that, you can't do this. There's no point in you doing that. You know, you're not good enough for this. You can't do that. That would be criminal. People say that you should allow kids to dream, but surely that's what everybody does. Everybody must have a dream, because you've got to have ambition, or what have you got? You know, I know you've got to sit down and go, okay, you know, maybe you want to write for the New York Times or something like that one day, and that's your dream. But there's nothing wrong with that, because you've got something there that you want to do. It's a positive thing. And I think once you stop dreaming, or people take dreams away from you, I think that's a terrible thing to do, because you've literally stopped them progressing anywhere. And I think, you know, when I hear people talk to kids and I hear them talk to players, don't do that, you can't do that. Why? If you're telling somebody you can't do it, they won't do it. Yet they could do it. And again, if you're looking at the players and they're telling them they can't do this and can't do that, you're supposed to be coaching them. So if you can't coach them to do it, either A, your recruitment's horrendous, or B, you can't coach them, so you shouldn't be there in the job.
Like you mentioned there, the school, I mean, you transitioned from football into education, and that kind of the transition from, you know, playing high level professional sport to, you know, rejoining, in quotation marks, you know, normal society, it can be a very tough one. Many former footballers have failed to adapt well without football in their lives. But your book is probably one of the first times I've really seen somebody like really comprehensively apply your lived experiences in sport to the rest of life. So when you did finally retire, was that transition easier for you than most, do you think?
No. I'm not sure, to be fair, because I'm never one for looking like 10 years ahead or 5 years and having massive plans. I've probably got more plans now than I ever had that, and that's probably because I've probably got slightly more confidence than I used to have in certain things. So I'm sort of, I just go with the flow, basically. I should be Irish, I think. So I should just, yeah, whatever, we'll do it. Yeah, okay, let's just do it. Only little things bother me, you know.
Yeah.
So going into school, you go into a staff room where you have loads of different kind of characters. There's my dressing room. You have a headmaster. There's my manager. You have a deputy head. There's my coach. You know, and then you have the philosophy in the school. And, you know, you get the lazy ones. You get the ones that are really, you know, go above and beyond. You get the people who just do their time and don't do anything else. So you get a mixture of personalities, and that's all football is really. And you get a head who sets a philosophy, and you do what you can to work within that philosophy. And as long as it's positive and as long as it's good, it's fine. And I've been quite lucky, to be fair, that I found people who, you know, especially the one I've got now, is really positive and really wants the kids to do well. And, you know, working in the area that I work in, we've had kids who are deemed failures at other schools. And we just try and reignite what they've got and tell them they can do this. And, you know, we work out a program individually for them, you know, because at the end of the day, we're not all the same, are we? So, you know, I think it's a lot like football, you know, and I think, you know, if you do, it'd be the same banter in the police as a fire engine, the fire service, as the ambulance service. The banter's always the same. It's always quite harsh banter because you're in that environment, and people looking in wouldn't appreciate that banter. And it's the same with a football club. You know, if you sat on the sideline and think, oh, that's a bit harsh, oh, that's a bit harsh. But once you're in it, it's because you care about everybody. You're allowed to absolutely slaughter each other and have a right good time. But if somebody does attack you from outside, you all stick together. And I think it's similar with that with the schools. Any organisation like that, I think, you know, the public service is like that. The only problem you've got in some of them is the politics. It's because that is a problem as well. That is a problem because there's so much that people don't want you to do anymore that you used to be able to do. So for me, I tried going into management. I tried coaching. And I just couldn't put up with idiots. And that was half of my problem. Right. If I thought it was wrong, I would just say, well, I'm not happy with this.
Yeah.
Because I believe that if I go and tell him, then they've got a chance to either change it or explain to me why he's doing it. And I think that's a better way than talking behind somebody's back. You just go to him and say, look, I think this is shit. These are the reasons why I think it's shit. And he either goes, well, we're doing this because of this. Or, okay, fair enough. If that's how you feel, we can do this, this and this. Or you can go. And I'm quite happy with that. But if I don't say it, I think maybe the fellow doesn't actually realise what's happening, or he does realise it's happening, but he might be a bit lost. But at the end of the day, I would hate for someone to sit in a dressing room or a staff room and talk about me behind my back and not have the decency to come say it to my face. Because only then can I deal with it, and I can, you know, it's off my chest, and I'd rather have it off my chest so it doesn't bother me anymore than it, and he knows. And if he doesn't think as highly as me, well, that's his problem and not my problem. But I'd like to give somebody a chance to fix it for me before I, you know, rather than sitting down and going, oh, he's a twat, isn't he? Yeah, but he's a twat. Yeah, but I'm only saying it in here. As soon as he comes in, all right, boss, how are you going? I don't like any of that. I'd rather it just be, look, this is how it is. This is what I think, and it's up to you. Sometimes it gets me in trouble, and sometimes it don't. In the main, I've come away and gone, I'm glad I said it, because it would eat away at me.
How has it been the last few months with work and being an educator during the pandemic for you?
Well, it's been great, to be fair, because we got sent home when we were shot. I've got a foster kid here. So what we did is I did some open university courses. So we sort of got up, started at 10 o'clock, worked through till about 2:30 on his schoolwork and on my courses. And then we had a chill out. So it was like a working day for us, really. And if I want to go back and do a bit at night, I found that if I was really interested in the courses, I just wanted to smash through them. So, you know, like I say, there's some 24-hour courses you're supposed to do 3 hours a day. There's some hour courses that you can do in, like, lunchtime. The Open University free courses were great for me. I did lots of stuff on depression, anxiety, you know, working as a team, communication, all the kind of things that would be useful in school for me. But I also did some criminal psychology and stuff about fingerprints because I was interested in that too. So, but again, that had some good things in it that I could take back into school. So yeah, for me, it was, while we weren't in school, it was good in as much as that, you know, I could probably upskill myself. And obviously now we're back in school and it is slow and we don't know what's going to happen. So I think the problem for everybody was nobody could give a definitive date on when it was going to end. You know, yeah. If you said, well, you're going to have to take your time off between now and the 1st of September, everyone would go, yeah, okay, great. Because nobody knew what was going on. And let's be honest, nobody still knows. We haven't got any real leadership in the country. You know, if that would have been me, I'd have sat down with the scientists. I would have pulled all the party leaders together and said, right, let's show a united front. This is the way we're going to do it. And everybody around the table agrees. All the leaders of the political parties agree that this is the way forward. You get one message. and you've got a sensible message. And no matter what party you follow, you hear your own leader say, this is the best way. And everyone's agreed. And I think that would have been a nice, strong message and a simple way of bringing a country under, if you like, with one clear message. And all we got was the scientists saying one thing, Johnson saying another, Labour saying another, the Greens saying another, Lib Dems saying something else. And you had five different views. And really, the only person we ever should have listened to was a scientist.
Yeah.
Because he knew what was going on. Yeah, the problem that everyone's got is that nobody knows where to go for the truth. Could you tell me what the truth is anymore? Because I have no idea. You know, when you look at the television and he comes out and the scientist says one thing and then he says the exact opposite, you're thinking, okay, have they decided that beforehand? Does he, you know, what is going on? But I don't think anybody quite knows what the truth is anymore. You know, you've got all sorts of people coming out. Is this mask any good? No, it's not. Is that visor any good? No, it's not. What about this mask? Or you should be wearing this mask. And the sort of, you know, the social distancing, it's just been so muddled that I think it has been bad for people's mental health because you can't get a definitive answer on anything. You know, if you say, what's a game on telly tonight? You go, Man United Liverpool. You know it's Man United Liverpool because it's there. But if you say, well, what's a mask's the best? You go into work the next day and you go, oh, I won't be wearing that one. I've seen this survey that says it's rubbish. You know, I've seen that the visors don't work. I've seen this, and you've got so many publications, and I think that's the problem we've got, is that there's people get fed up because there's no real truth. And if there's no real truth, you tend to fend for yourselves and make the best of it. You know, and if you see, and I'm not defending, I mean, if you see nobody in your immediate family having any problems, you know, you're just going to crack on as a normal life. If you see somebody in trouble, then you're going to be a bit more careful. But we couldn't quite convey that from the Prime Minister, could we? And you look at Trump. Trump's just a madman, you know, in charge of a massive country. So he's just saying whatever he wants. And then they say, well, you said this. And he goes, no, I didn't actually say that. So, I mean, so we have a problem at the moment in society where there's not any truth. And that's a problem. And we get it in racism. We get it in gender. We get it in sport. We get it in politics. We get it in health. We get it in everything. And you know, when you go to somewhere, you want to know the truth. And I think it's so hard now for anybody to get what the truth is. You take transgender people, right? They play sport. There's been certain ex-athletes who come out and say they shouldn't be doing that. They're breaking the law. They're doing this. Well, they shouldn't really be having to go at the trans people. If they're worried, they should be having to go to the authorities because the trans people are only following the rules of what the rules of the competitions are. They just go into the competition and go, right, do I qualify for competition? Yeah, I do, so I can go in it.
Yeah.
You know, and football, above everything else, is going to have problems with them in the future. And so is athletics. It's just a muddled old world at the moment. And I feel as though that we don't have enough mature adults to have a mature conversation about anything, because it's always us versus them. You know, you look at Farage, whatever happens, he wants to divide the country. And then if it doesn't go his way, he wants to do something else. Tommy Robinson the same. Boris Johnson came out with a statement the other day about asylum seekers on the boat. They all have to go back. Well, they don't all have to go back because he hasn't heard any of their cases yet. So he's making a sweeping statement about people who have come over on. Yes, they might use a boat to get to this country, but their cases have to be heard on an individual basis. You can't just say they've all got to go home because that's discrimination straight away. What happens if by sending one of them people back, they're going to get killed? He just says stuff to make himself look good.
It does seem kind of mad that Nigel Farage will post a video like that, and then literally the next day you have BBC and Sky News out there looking for the same videos. So it is kind of like a mental situation where he's not even an elected official, you know, and the kind of news cycle all follows what he's saying now all of a sudden.
Yeah, but unfortunately, because of the coronavirus, they were quite happy that people come across on boats because it took the mind off what a shambles the virus has been. You know, when you talk to any nurse or any doctor, you realise how hard it is. You know, I had a Twitter message of a fella whose dad was in an induced coma and they weren't sure what was going to happen. So I sent him a message and I said, look, when you get out, I'll give you a ring. And funny enough, he come out and I rang him and they said to him, look, you know, we didn't think you'd make it, the state of your lungs. It's going to take him a year to recover. And I'm struggling from, you know, sort of walk to the back door to walk into his garden. And you think that's what you've got to should be focusing on. That's where your help should be, not just saying stuff because it's, you know, because it's popular. Immigration needs sorting out. The racism needs sorting out. The gender needs sorting out. You know, society needs sorting out. You just can't keep on loading the top and crushing the bottom, because that's not going to work. So you need to work from the bottom up and not the top. But unfortunately, we have a situation here where if you look at the House of Commons now on Prime Minister's Question Times, if Keir Starmer says something, Boris Johnson goes, yeah, but you did that. And these are our politicians who have spent years supposedly debating serious matters. And they go, yeah, but it was you. You did that first. You did that. And it's like a couple of kids.
Yeah.
What you really need is to say, okay, look, for me, it would be the first thing we do is go, right, there's an amnesty for 6 months. Anybody here illegally, you've got to sign in at the police station. If you don't after that, you're going back no matter what, because we give you 6 months. And we'll put it on all different languages, and we'll put it all on the news, and we'll put it on the radio, everywhere we can put it, so that people know. Then we'll realise how many people we've got in this country. And then we'll go from there, go, right, okay, how many people do we want to allow into the country at a year, say? Okay, and then what is our emergency procedure if we have to go and bomb a country, or there's a crisis in another country and they want to come here? So we have to have an emergency number as well, just in case. So we could say we took, I don't know, say it for instance, 100,000 a year. And then we said, well, look, if there's a crisis, we could take another 20,000. We haven't got that. No, because nobody will talk to it, because it doesn't win votes. The only way it wins votes is by making them the enemy and saying, look, these are taking your jobs, these are taking your benefits. And it's completely wrong. And I think we need to have that conversation with that. We need to look at why there's so much racism in this country. We need to look at the LGBT side, the gender side of what's going on, and their rights. But nobody will do it. You know, I don't know how far you got in that book, but you know, there's a bit on sex workers and stuff like that. They pay their taxes. You know, they do the job, they pay their taxes, and yet nobody's done anything for them. They've just been left to fend for themselves.
Yeah.
And I think if we're going to have people who are in poverty, people who are doing jobs sometimes they don't, you know, they have to do. Sometimes they like doing it, to be fair, but we've got to look after the littlest people, if you like, in society first, before we look after the biggest, because the biggest can take care of themselves. But if we can look at how are we having kids who have to go to a food bank? How are we having kids? You know, they're getting free school meals. Why are we doing that? And now we've got a train on the horizon of 150 billion HS2. And I'm thinking, what a mixed message is that to give? You can send somebody down to a food bank, but we're building a train for 100 billion. You know, well, the furlough's got to come to the end about paying people who are struggling financially. But we can build this track and we can put a nice shiny train in it for what is probably well over 100 billion. What sort of signal are they sending out? Yeah, you're in the shit, but you know, that's basically tough. But look at my shiny new train I can have. And I think we need to realise what's important. I think if the pandemic's taught us anything, it's what's important. And what makes a country great? It's not the buildings, is it? It's the people. You know, the people make the place great, not anything else. To be fair, we've got through this pandemic, like we get through everything, because of the people. It's very rarely we get through something because we have a really great leader. It's because the people who make sacrifices lower down. And we've got millions of people who do fantastic work all through the charity. I see it every day. And yet, we have people at the top who seem to just steamroll through and put the country second and their political careers first. And that ain't right. And I think at the moment in the world, we've probably got the worst examples of that ever. And again, what are we showing our kids? Well, it's great. You can go in, you can be racist, homophobic, sexist, and lie. And that's perfectly acceptable because you can run a country. Now, if your kids come in and started lying, were racist and sexist, well, how would you feel? But now, it's perfect. Yeah. But you'd be embarrassed, wouldn't you? And you'd be ashamed and you'd never go to them. But it's perfectly acceptable for somebody to run the country who's exactly like that. And I think we've entered a period where lying has become okay because it's good old Boris. Lying has become okay because it's Trump and he just goes, well, I didn't say it. So I do think there's going to come a point where things have to change. And, you know, I can't see Boris Johnson lasting long. I don't think Trump will get in next time, but you never know. You know, and at the same time, we've made a massive moan up about Trump's wall, yet we spent 12 million on a fence in Calais long before Trump ever mentioned the wall. So I think there's, you know, there's lots of things wrong, but underneath there's lots of great people doing lots of great stuff. But it's just how we highlight that and how we get people at the top to have a, I suppose, an adult conversation. It's like, yeah, if I say to you, you know, this, and you go, oh, no. It's got to be an adult conversation that was had because it's the right conversation to have. Not because you're going to score points, not because you're going to win votes, because it's the right conversation to have about immigration, about race, about gender, about everything that we can do. And I thought that was Parliament was for, but it seems to be about scoring points and staying in power. Well, there's no point in having them there if that's the case, because they don't do much, do they? Let's be honest, apart from score points for each other. I think you shouldn't be able to, if it was me, I'd be going, okay, I'll tell you what then, now you're in power. Are you based in Dublin?
Mullingar. It's a couple of hours outside Dublin.
I've been to Mullingar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've been to Mullingar, yeah. So say your local, you have MPs here, don't you?
Yeah, we call them TDs, but yeah, they're the same thing.
Yeah, so if you said, tell you what, for every one person who's homeless or in poverty, we will take X amount of money, pounds out of your wages. It seemed bloody curious, wouldn't they? Or you've got 6 months to do this, or else you're out. This is your agenda, because you work for the people. The people don't work for you, work for the people, right? So go in there, and you need to sort out the homeless people, and you need to sort out the poverty, and you need to sort out the healthcare, you need to sort out the garden over there, and you need to crack on. And I think that's, at the moment, they go in there, and you know, what was that thing? The fella claimed 39 pence for 100 yards drive down the road in his car. What is that about? So I do think, well, the people on the streets are quite mature and quite good. I think the leaders at the top have been the most immature leaders we've had for a long, long time. And I think that's been a problem. We've probably been hit with a virus in probably the worst possible time because of the two idiots in the top.
I just want to touch on the kind of mental health aspect of the book, because that's obviously a huge part of it. You kind of touch on, you know, the fact that, you know, in football, it's not such a, it's been one of those things that's been avoided for so long. And there has been the advent of sports psychologists being brought into clubs and so on and so forth. But it's still, you know, one of those things that's not talked about a lot. But I wonder if it's changing a bit, because I remember reading Joe Bryan, the Fulham fullback, recently. He had an interview where he spoke very candidly about that and about dealing with mental health issues. And I don't know if you've heard of Richie Sadlier.
Vaguely familiar.
He was a former Millwall striker and also played for Ireland, and he kind of suffered with a lot of addiction problems, alcoholism and all that. And, you know, he came through all that. He's actually a psychotherapist now in Dublin. He wrote a book last year called Recovering. The book isn't really about football at all. It's kind of like yours. He talks about his issues and kind of coming through them and all that. And just to see like a former footballer have an entire book where he's opening up about his addiction and the anxiety that he had over years. And I kind of wonder, do you see that changing in football, this kind of conversation slowly getting there where it's okay now for professional sports people to open up?
Yeah, I think, look, in the old days, like I said to you before, you weren't allowed to show a sign of weakness, any weakness. And then with other sports having psychologists, they started to come in towards the end. I remember that one psychologist coming to us with Wales once, with Bobby Gould, brought him in, and I looked at him and the sweat was pouring out from under his arms, and I thought, he's nervous about meeting us, and he's a sports psychologist, and now he's supposed to be telling us how to prepare for the games, and there's only 15 or 16 of us in this room and he's sweating his head off. So I thought, right, okay. But I think, look, I'm really worried at the moment that it appears trendy. What I want is something long term, because I don't want it to be trendy and then all of a sudden something else come along and be trendy and everybody wants to do it. If you're really serious about sports psychologists, why are they at the top? Why aren't they at the bottom when your kid, say if you've got, a 12-year-old who's been with Man United or another club for 6 years, and all of a sudden they turn around and tell him that it's not good enough anymore. That fella's had a dream for 6 years. Or even if he goes for a trial and he's told not, he's not good enough, that can crush people. So we do it more in academy football. We do it more on trials, more on through all the junior stuff. So why aren't we doing it there? Why aren't we talking to the people who have to make them decisions? Is there a format we could use that makes the kid get over his disappointment quick enough? Because he's going to be disappointed and he could be crushed. But is there a way that we can actually I suppose, work that in, if we've kept them on for a bit, that there might be a failure later on? Is it a way that if we set up a train, you know, a trial match, that there's a way of putting it across? Because you need to stop crushing people's dreams at the bottom end, never mind the top. At the top, well, like I say, you can have a psychologist and it's good. And, you know, the psychologist is probably more needed on both ends, really. But the top is more to deal with, and I'm only guessing, really, the anxiety around the match and your life outside. Because these days, if you buy a Ferrari and you buy another one and then you buy a Bentley, where is your life going? So I suppose at the top level now, because of the amount of money, they need more purpose and direction than they ever have done. Because while it's like a lottery winner, you win the lottery every week or every year, and all of a sudden you've got this much money you don't quite know what to do with. You have no sort of direction. I mean, lots of them are quite good, but there's some of them who just don't have a clue what they're going to do. So it becomes an issue. And I suppose to get that buzz, you know, some turn to drink, some to drugs, some just worry about things. And I think it's really hard at the top of time because of they have so much money. That is a problem around the game, because there seems to be a lot more pressure now. Yeah, you can understand the anxiety. But I still go back to the same thing. Is there a way that we can bring something out where we tell the people in a better way than what we're doing now? And then what happens to the people who have to tell a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old that he ain't good enough? Well, what's their mental health like? You know, the manager of the academy, when he has to tell a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old that they're not taking him on, you know, he was looking for his first contract, but he's got to go.
Yeah, you pointed that out in the book, and I was very interested, actually, because that's something that people don't bring up. People don't think about the guy who has to constantly, because one person, obviously the person who you're talking about, the player, obviously they get rejected and that's horrible. But then there's one person who is responsible for the rejection of multiple people. And yeah, that was interesting when I read when I read that in the book.
What happens to them? But in this day and age, why isn't there something blanketed by the psychologists that we could use in school? You know, just simple things probably that you could use in school. But I'm not clever enough to come up with it, but I'm sure there's a way of talking to people, there's a way of getting people ready for rejection, for success. And, you know, when you think about it, we say to these kids, oh, by the way, work hard all year and there's an exam at the end. But you never practice your exams, really, do you? Because how would you replicate that? Players can't replicate penalty shootouts because there's different factors. So you look at the exams, you look at penalty shootouts. How do this? It's a kid's equivalent of a penalty shootout. How can we train the kids to actually get to that point? How much pressure can we put on them to get a result? And then is it fair to the people who are not great with pressure to put them in a pressurised position? So, you know, we say we're child-centred in education, but are we really? Because it should be down for the individual. And I look at this fiasco that's just happened now, and I think sometimes the people that are good at exams, it's like doing your driving test. You listen to what you have to do, you get through what you have to get through, then you remember it, then you pass your exam, then you drive how you want. Some people really struggle, it takes them 4, 5, or 10. Is it a way of determining who should take an exam and who should be judged on a course, you know, over a year? And if we're really child-centred, then we should be looking at both, surely. But looking at the work over the year is deemed to be not as good. Yeah, he's done a year's work, but loses his future in 2 hours. That to me doesn't make any sense, because this kid's done all the work for a year, but can't quite remember pattern fashion what he's supposed to have done. And you can say he should know it. Well, we've all been in pressure situations where we just can't think straight. And if you're one of them and we haven't given the tools to do that, surely we're better off judging him over the year and saying that's as good as an exam. And I do think we need to come to that stage. It just seems bonkers that we don't do both. We only have to do one. Now, he's not going to go into your university and do 2.5 hours work, are they? They're going to go into your university for 3 years. So if you look at his coursework, well, actually, over a year, this coursework is fantastic. But he didn't get a B or a C. But his coursework would have done easily. But we'll reject him because we need to get him into university. And I think it's mad. I think it's mad that everything should be geared towards that instead of looking back on that. And it should be a big bit of the year, the amount of effort he's putting through the year. I don't get why you should lose your future in 2.5 hours, because it's, well, I wouldn't like to sit an exam. You imagine now, right? You're in a classroom, I don't know what your school was like. It's still pretty noisy, even though the teacher's teaching. It's still pretty noisy, and there's lots going on, and it's, you know, the teacher's quite loud, and all of a sudden you go into an exam room and you have to be quiet, and you're not allowed to talk to anybody, and you're isolated, totally foreign to what you've done all year. So it doesn't make it. Exams don't never make any sense to me.
Yeah,
it's just is a silly thing at the end that people make you do, and then you go, you've done fantastic this year, but in 2.5 hours, you'll either ruin your life or it'll be okay. And that's a hell of a thing to go through, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. And I mean, it's kind of like a running joke in Ireland about how the leaving cert, our kind of big exam at the end of school, how people still have nightmares about doing it, you know, even 20 years on. But I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of the book.
Well, see if you can stay awake. All right, mate, I'll speak to you soon.
All right, thanks a million for coming on, Neville, and have a good evening. Cheers.
Cheers, mate. Ta-ra. Ta-ra.